David Landis, I'm here on behalf of the appellant, the estate of Daniel Ford. Before proceeding, I'd like to request 2 minutes for rebuttal time.
Watch your time, Mr. Foster.
Thank you. Appellant is requesting that this honorable court reverse the decision of the 8th District Court of Appeal, which in turn affirms the decision of the trial court. The issue before us today is whether it is prejudicial error for a trial judge to instruct a jury regarding the Catholic Command statute where there has been a substantial amount of credible evidence on that issue.
If there's substantial credible evidence that is equal on both sides of the issue of pilot in command, should the charge be given?
No, Your Honor. In 1957, in the Ayers decision, this court reaffirmed the position that there is a great propensity with rebuttable presumption to confuse the jury, for the jury to treat these rebuttable presumptions as if they are evidence or as if they are conclusive presumptions. And for that reason, the court, I think, correctly adopts the position that has been taken right there, and I agree more that they should fall completely and allow the jury to look at all of the evidence.
I know it's not your side of the case, but what substantial credible evidence is there that your client was not the pilot in command?
No, I think, Your Honor, the only evidence that was presented that my client was not the pilot in command comes from the testimony of athlete's own experts who looked to the fact that my client was even the lessee, that my client had filed a flight plan and indeed made a determination and informed the jury that he believed my client was not the pilot in command. But looking at all of the other evidence, that all of the other experts based their decisions that my client was not the pilot in command, I think it's evidence that the facts go the other way. First, there had been several flights that took place within several days of the incident in question. All of those flights involved the same two individuals. The logbook from those flights clearly indicated that Dietrich, the employee pilot and assistant chief pilot of Midwest, the employee, had been pilot command during those several flights.
Because they were instructional. Is that why?
I don't necessarily agree with you, but they were instructional. Prior to these flights, my client had never flown this very complicated, powerful type of airplane. His experience is greatly distinguished by the experience of Dietrich,
yes,
who has flown this type of plane on several other occasions.
Well, and he's an instructor, though. It wasn't that, I mean, it seemed from reading the briefs, counsel, that the issue that separates the two sides is just one, and that is whether or not this was an instructional flight. That dictates the result.
Respectfully, Your Honor, I don't necessarily agree with you.
Okay.
Indeed, I believe that there's evidence that goes outside of the instructional issue, which supports my position that Dietrich was a pilot command. I think most pointedly, the president of Apple Inc. testified that out of concern for the safety of his best friend Ford, who was assigning an employee of his company to act as pilot in command, to take Ford wherever he needed to go during that period of time. That certainly goes outside the instruction issue, I believe, Your Honor. Additionally, this was a $650,000 airplane. The title of it remains with Apple Inc. company. For them to give the plane to somebody who has no experience to be pilot in command just does not read with logic.
But it doesn't.
Isn't there also evidence that the maneuver just before the crash was one that was done through instruction?
I mean, obviously there was a great deal of evidence that pointed to the fact that at the time of this crash, my client was getting instruction. Indeed, there was an employee test pilot of Midwest, as Your Honor recalled, that looked up just prior to the crash and described what he saw as an instructional maneuver. The vice president of Appley Midwest, in a property claim report, attested to the fact that Dietrich was the pilot in command. Again, these are facts that go outside of the instructional issue.
Well, I think, counsel, we could argue the facts probably for 15 minutes, but isn't the issue before us what the law is going to be on presumption, particularly where the General Assembly has stated that there is a rebuttable presumption? Isn't there a difference? Should we see a difference, I guess, between the judge-created presumption that the civil rule seems to apply, 301, and the statutory presumption where the General Assembly has said there will be a rebuttable presumption. Should we look at those differently or not, do you think?
Well, I think, Your Honor, that it's necessary to look at the legislative intent for each of the statutes that have been enacted by the legislature. Ayers obviously talked about the propensity that these rebuttal presumptions have to confuse jurors. And in 1980, the Ayers opinion was endorsed by Ohio Evidence Rule 301, which dealt with presumptions in general in civil action. And it is expressly stated that it does not change Ohio law relative to the effect of civil of presumptions in civil cases, and it cites Ayers. And indeed, it states that it is both talking about presumptions that are created in common law and presumptions that were created by the legislature.
Well, the 301 really, in all civil actions and proceedings not otherwise provided for by statute enacted by the General Assembly, these rules, the presumption imposes, and so forth. Is that, do you think that supersedes what the statute says with respect to when the presumption can be used or applied?
Well, I
think it applies to both statutory presumptions and common law. But
I believe that the staff has accompanied that rule are enlightening to that effect. The legislature should not have been held to have intended to call for the instruction in this case. There's nothing I'd say that suggested that sentence could have been communicated to the jury. And where it is ambiguous, the rules of construction are necessarily invoked.
Under what circumstances would you have the instruction given?
Your Honor, I think consistent with Ayers, consistent with 301, if there had not been a substantial amount of credible evidence presented on the issue of who would tell in command, I believe wholeheartedly that the statute enacted by the legislature should be communicated to the jury.
So that when there is little or no evidence on the subject, then the instruction should be given.
Well, and I'm reluctant to sway from the precise language, substantial credible evidence. If there is
well, substantial is different than little, isn't it?
Yeah, I believe so.
So the trial court has to weigh that in determining whether or not he gives the instruction depending on the evidence as he's heard it.
I believe that is correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
Let me follow up that question. In fact, doesn't the statute anticipate that there may be evidence that would tend to rebut the presumption? It says the pilot command is rebuttably presumed to be. Doesn't that say that the suggestion between, I guess, suggests that the trial judge makes a decision as to whether there is some evidence that's credible, I suppose, that could be used to rebut the presumption? Then that's a jury question. I guess I don't understand what the prejudice here is in giving the jury the statute and saying, you've got evidence on both sides. That General Assembly said there's a presumption that, based upon who's sitting where, that one of them is the pilot in command. But jury, you can find otherwise. From the evidence, you have a lot of evidence that the jury could have found otherwise. But why do we wipe out the presumption, I guess, and the General Assembly seems to anticipate that there would be rebuttable evidence?
Well, the Ayers case was informative on that issue, Your Honor. In Ayers, they found that single rebuttable presumption was fraught with risk, and that admonishing the jury that they should consider all of the evidence didn't rectify the situation, that they would misuse such a rebuttable presumption. I think here there's no need to speculate as to whether the jury misused the rebuttable presumption. When looking to the questions that they brought to the judge, I'll quote it. Interpretation of state law rates pilot and left seat, and if such pilot flight plan is determined to be pilot command, what are the exceptions? Your Honor, they are raising the question premised on the apparent belief that they're dealing with a conclusive presumption subject to exception.
I'm not sure, you will argue that in your brief, counsel, but I'm not sure I buy your result from that shows that indeed this jury was confused. That just doesn't necessarily flow from the question, does it?
Oh, I believe that it does, respectfully, Your Honor.
It shows that they were looking at it. It shows they were reviewing it. So we know they looked at it, right?
I'm afraid it does.
Yes, we know that part. But I just don't know that. I'm not following you on why that is a slam dunk that they were confused.
Well, I think the word exception, Your Honor, is entirely displaced in the context.
Yes.
The exception, it goes against the concept of rebuttal presumption. And without answering the question whether there are exceptions to this rule, the judge simply handed to them a copy of the statute along with the definition of the term presumption, along with the definition of the term rebuttal presumption, with an admonition to consider all of the evidence.
So why wouldn't that? They didn't have a copy before. They just had it orally read to them. Sure. So what's your argument for why that didn't, in the whole big scheme of things, it's expected that jurors will be able to follow instructions. We actually presume that they will, right? So now they have it. They were confused, but now they have it, and they're told to use it in the way you would want them. If they had to have it at all, at least the judge said, consider all the evidence, and it's rebuttable. Why isn't that cure the problem?
I believe that if you look at the statute, and for your honesty, me and to reprint it on appendix 23, it's an extremely complicated statute, and I myself took a great deal of time to try to figure out what the legislature was intending for it to happen. There are several irrelevant passages in the statute that were given to the jury. For example, Section F, which speaks in terms of a conclusive presumption, has no application or bearing to the case at hand. Section F deals with a situation where the occupant's position at the time of the crash should not be determined. There are other...
But counsel, have to assume that a jury can sort that out, too? I mean, you would rather they didn't get it. I understand that because of the potential for confusion. But we have a curing instruction. You would disagree, I assume, that couldn't cure the problem.
Indeed,
I know. But but we have the curing, and more importantly, and the next question I want you to address, please, is the just to give it. Let's assume it's error for a moment, that your position is entirely correct, that in this scenario it had no place. Address, if you would, please, how your client was prejudiced. You just want to say they were confused. But, okay.
Not only were they confused, Your Honor, but I think that the statute unreasonably focuses the jury's attention on the lower prong of seeing. Indeed, seeing was something that was raised in the question.
But I have to ask you, counsel, wasn't that part of the evidence in the case? Wasn't everybody, your experts, their experts, everybody was talking about seating? In fact, everybody was talking about all the things that are in that statute. They were saying, here's the way we decide. We have flight plans, we have instruction or not instruction, we have seating, we have controls. Aren't those the same things you were putting in the case without any statutory presumption?
A great deal of evidence was put into the case outside of those base facts that are included in the statute. Unfortunately, I'm afraid that those other pieces of evidence were lost in this confusion.
That's your thought, that this sort of overtook your other base facts, as you call them in your brief.
Indeed, Your Honor, the fact that they're asking for exceptions and the fact that rather than explaining what a rebuttable presumption is and that there is no need to think of exceptions, the judge hands them the statute, which has four provisions dealing with seating. Sections A, B, C, and F. B and C and F have no application to the case at hand, all focus on seating. The fact that the judge communicated the statute twice, the jury only made it more significant of an error. The fact that he communicated all of the passages and these relevant ones made it more. Appellant has full confidence that had the jury been able to deliberate unencumbered by the pilot command statute, they would have reached the same conclusion that every expert, with the exception of the experts for Appellee Midwest, had reached, and that is a defect in the pilot command.
Should that verdict have been tested with interrogatory so that you would have that? You would be able to tell us exactly that? Is that a problem here, that the jury verdict wasn't tested in any way?
You know, according to Ayers, the court really stated that it was error per se to give a jury...
And so we don't measure it as prejudicial or not?
Well, I think that there's so much evidence that it is prejudicial in this case.
But, I mean, we do take that next step, don't we, even under Ayers?
I believe so, Your Honor. Regrettably, the injunction that was provided by the Honorable Trial Judge diverted the jury's attention from a lot of the necessary facts that was considered. And as a result, they focused upon this hierarchy, I think unreasonably, and to appellant's detriment. And for that reason, appellant is requesting that the 8th District Court of Appeals decision be referred.
Thank you, Mr. Landau.
May I please the court, Chief Justice, and justices? My name is Maggie Mitchell. I represent the Appleys. The Appleys were several companies, one company that owned the aircraft that Mr. Ford received for purchasing, and the other company that employed Mr. Dietrich, who was sitting on the right seat of the aircraft during the accident. Your Honor, I noticed a number of questions regarding statute. And I feel it's very important to give you some background on the purpose of the statute in the context of aviation. Mr. Landau had indicated that it is his analysis that some statutory construction is necessary in this case. And to the extent that I agree with Frank on this case, but if you take what the appellant is asking you to do and look behind the statute, there is some legislative history, although it is not required in Ohio, find in my brief in the Senate Judiciary Committee report, which gives the background of this statute. And what it really is a manner, a set of rules that, unlike Mr. Landover's argument to you that it must be piecemeal, this statute makes no sense unless all the provisions are applied. And it is for the very reason that the Aviation Law Subcommittee that made up the basis for that Senate Judiciary Report and ultimately the statute said these are a set of rules that are taken from the aviation industry. What they are designed to do is look at the level of qualification of the, if there are two licensed pilots, and that is the kind of situation that happened in this accident, two fully qualified men sitting in the left and the right seat, both able to manipulate the controls of the aircraft. That's what the statute was designed to target when there's a crash and both pilots die and nobody on the ground prior to the incident knows what those two pilots were intending to do that day during that flight. The level of qualification, the reason the statute has to be applied in its entirety as an aid to the jury, not as a substitution for evidence, but as an aid, as permissible inferences the jury can draw from base facts, is because the lefty in aviation, the lefty, there are no other facts, and there are two people and both die, and one of the lefties is presumed to be in aviation.
Let's see if we can agree on something. The Ayers case. Now, I know you cite Myers. That may very well be distinguishable on the criminal contest. Let's just start with Ayers. Do you agree that Ayers says and holds that if there's substantial credible evidence that the person in the left front seat is not the pilot in command, that the instruction should not be given? Is that what Ayers says?
Ayers says that if we take it to the distinction of a common law presumption, yes, Your Honor, okay. Says substantial credible evidence is presented, the court is not constructed.
Okay. Then the second, to follow up that, why, you've talked about these various corporate holdings. There were three or four separate corporations, I think. Mr. Garrity owned them all, or was at least the operating head of all of them. I think he owned them all. He testified, did he not, that it was his intention that Dietrich, his own employee, was to be the pilot in command of the plane that day on this flight.
Your Honor, if he did so testify, but that did not explain what occurred on the day of the accident, immediately prior to the accident. And it doesn't, because there are two qualified. Mr. Ford, whether he had less or more time, was a highly qualified pilot. He had been transitioning from a very sophisticated aircraft to another sophisticated aircraft. That's why Mr. Garrity's testimony isn't direct proof, circumstantial or otherwise. And I may have you know, I take things quite literally. When this court says direct evidence and direct proof, to me that means someone you can touch, feel, or see, or talk to, they can say, yes, these dominoes were going to go on an instructional flight. Your Honor, there was no competent, credible evidence to that effect. There were only expert witnesses who were saying these things, but not one of those witnesses could say who was actually flying the aircraft. And, Your Honor, that really is where the statutory rebuttable presumptions in Judge McDonald's wisdom had to come in, because it is a custom and practice. The hierarchy is all pilots that fly, and juries very rarely will find juries who have that luxury, but to have that knowledge. It's a hierarchy. Let's be first, then it's instructional instructor. It's an instrument flight rule that is the most qualified level of flying. That's why that those rules had to take effect, because there was no evidence. Your Honor, let me say yes and no, and let me explain my answer. The federal aviation regulations do not go any further than what Judge McDonald was charged, which is the pilot command is the person solely responsible for the flight. The custom and practice in aviation is the person with an instrument rating who files the flight plan, even if there's an instructor aboard, is frequently, because he has an opportunity flight which requires a level of qualification that may not be required, may not even be possessed by the instructor. He or she is now flying under instrument flight conditions, which means bad weather, poor visibility, and that rating in the industry is probably the toughest other than airline pilot rating to achieve.
And this gentleman
could
be an instructor
in
material process.
I guess he could be. Now, Mr. Davis had an instrument.
Would that be extremely uncommon?
That would be, well, the question is, would he have an instructor's rating to teach it, or you mean an instructor's rating for instruments? That's not that uncommon. Not all instructors can teach instruments.
I'm saying the
license
flies to turboprop, not the instrument rating.
That would be uncommon. Most people get the instrument rating, and then if they're going to continue flying, they'll get a multi-instrument rating. That's more common.
But there's nothing in the FAA rule to indicate the instructor must fly on the flight plan, whether
it's a student. No, it does not. In fact, there is not. That's why when you look.
Isn't it actually common for the student to file it?
The student may file it or the instructor may file it. There is really no custom in practice. And frequently on.
So who files the flight plan really doesn't help at all in sort of that
instrument? Well, it is an instrument. Flight, yes, it does. In the custom practice in aviation, if it's an instrument flight, the person who files the flight plan as a pilot is deemed to be in control of the aircraft as a pilot in command, and deemed to be flying as the pilot in command. And that's why, if you read the Senate Judiciary Report, if you really look at the meaning of that statute, those set of rules attempt, when there is no witness to say who was really flying and committed the negligent act, to sort it out, because the federal aviation regulations don't go that far. And that's exactly what that Senate Judiciary Report said we're going to pick up where they left off, and we're going to provide a set of rules based upon the aviation industry to sort out a very difficult issue in low pilot side, and no one can provide any direct, and even circumstantial, if you want to say, any real evidence of who is lying.
Counsel, at the trial of this case, is it true that all these custom and practice in aviation industry, you know, the importance of who filed the flight plan, who was or wasn't rated for, wasn't all this exactly what the jury was told by various witnesses?
Your Honor, you're correct in the standpoint that expert witnesses came to give their opinion.
So that the jury, okay,
or the defense, to say who they deemed from past actions, for example, past flights between the two.
Well,
nobody could testify who was really flying the airplane and committed tremendous. And that, if you really look at the statute, it's saying it's really who was flying the airplane, then there would be a depot in command. This was where there was no evidence on who was actually flying the airplane. Nobody knew. Nobody could see who was flying it. Of course, the city of Alaska needed it to write, and there really was no evidence of who was manipulating the control immediately prior to the accident.
Did you say that there has to be direct evidence for this to apply?
Your Honor, the air case says direct evidence. It then also talks about evidence from indirect evidence. And, Your Honor, when I use the word direct evidence, and I took it in the air...
Well, it sounds like you're throwing out circumstantial evidence.
There wasn't circumstantial evidence, as far as I understand it, at the case either, Your Honor. There was no one who could say, well, I heard them saying they were going to do this, so that must mean they did do this.
So you're saying that if a witness says, from what I observed, the evidence to be, I would say that X was flying the plane. That you don't consider as evidence.
Your Honor, it's a form of opinion evidence that is different than someone who touches, sees, feels.
Well, is there a form that we allow, and is there a form we don't allow?
Well, I think the airspace, and I agree that the court speaks through its syllabus, but it also says, at two different points in that case that it requires direct evidence, and then Rule 301 of the staff notes says that the parallel proof is not permitted, presumption and direct evidence. And I think that I take this court's reasoning to heart, and it's based on you, that this court's looking for real proof of the presumed fact. Otherwise,
are you saying that circumstantial evidence is not real proof?
No, Your Honor, I'm not saying it is. It's an inference to the jury draw.
Do you distinguish circumstantial evidence from direct evidence?
Well, it is to be distinguished. It is distinguished in the law. And
has in this part, all of it should be treated the same?
That's what I'm saying. The syllabus in the United States versus the reasoning in the United States, there's a little bit of a conflict, and I don't know. I can say that in two very persuasive sections, to me persuasive in the United States, it talks about direct proof.
Just to make this easier, or simpler, isn't the fact that Eric's case, the syllabus seems to be broader than this in the fact of the case, and that's what happened. There was direct evidence in Eric, but the syllabus refers to both direct and non-direct evidence, so we have to, that's our problem.
Okay, just to
deal with the case.
You're correct, The witnesses on the ground believed that, and that's either two gentlemen that came out of the hangar or were watching the airplane, that they saw one engine completely shut off. And they saw the aircraft landing, and they assumed the airplane was going to land. And all of a sudden, it appeared that power was full power. The engine was slowing down, and one engine was still with location, Mr.
Palmer. Would that be a maneuver for which instruction is given?
It could
be. Is that part of the course of instruction for operators in the to do that maneuver?
At altitude, yes. Where they did it on the ground, no.
And it is not a maneuver that would be part of standard procedure?
No, it would not be. It would be, quite frankly, that would be a maneuver you would want. You'd shut an engine down on a twin engine when you're 2,000 or 3,000 feet up in the air to test its single engine capability, not when you're landing.
And if, in an instructional phase, that maneuver is undertaken by the students who want to actually execute, who is the target?
Your Honor, if all facts aside, if the person sitting in the left seat is qualified and executes the maneuver independent of instruction?
No, with instruction.
With instruction.
Told to do it by
instruction. Told to do it, well, that would be an instructional flight. He can't get around that. Right?
And then the
pilot is going to
be
a because he has a higher level
of
qualification under the rule of the
aviation industry. Nico, I'd like you to respond to Mr. Landiver's contention that giving the jury the statute was confusing to the jury, somewhat confusing to us. And I guess I'm wondering, wouldn't this be confusing to the jury to give the jury the entire statute, particularly when it includes sections that really don't apply to this case?
Your Honor, and I'm very glad you asked that question. There would be no way Judge McMonagle could possibly give portions of that statute to the jury. That statute was designed with a set of rules, and the hierarchy is there for a purpose. It's not to surplus. It's there for the jury to look the base facts to determine whether the base facts have improved. If they have, they go on to the next.
Well, he wouldn't need to give them half, would he?
Your Honor, he would need to give them the entire statute.
Why would he need to give them half if it was clear where the two pilots were sitting? Isn't that the fact? They did know who was
they were standing.
And I thought, as I read it applies to where you can't tell which pilot was
sitting. It's just they didn't run out of the aircraft.
Yeah, sure.
Your Honor, maybe I'm a bit of a purist, but I think we have to give them the entire set of rules since the statute was designed by the legislature to be an entire set of rules rather than to select out one. Certainly, you couldn't select out the part B or E and not give them out because it's a hierarchy. I mean, that's what the custom of the industry is in terms of determining who should or what apply.
Thank you
very much.
Mr. Landiver, you've used your time. It may take 30 seconds.
Thank you. Very briefly, looking at the bold policy that the Myers decision looked to in enacting the drug driving statute, this is not a statute that was enacted to promote a bold legislative or social policy. Here, we're looking to resolve a dispute, and you can't say that the legislature intended for the statute to be communicated to a jury where it just wasn't necessary. As this court noted, direct evidence is not necessarily better than circumstantial evidence, and not the error syllabus nor any decision which has reaffirmed the error syllabus requires it. Again, the common speculative question that the lower court decision to reverse.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised for our opinion.